topic of tonight's Dharma talk is karma and rebirth. A somewhat contentious topic in our culture. I'll talk about that to a certain extent. But first of all, what about the word karma itself? What does that actually mean? And there are, incredible misconceptions about both of these topics that have sort of entered our culture through the sort of the New Age world and various other places. And I want to put those to rest tonight if I can. And also, this isn't something that's sort of, quote, part of the culture we probably all grew up in. We all come from Western cultures that, unless you happen to grow up in a Hindu or a Buddhist household in the West, which is not that frequent, then these are topics that were never something you thought about and certainly aren't, we don't have the cultural references for them and the ingrained cultural belief in them. And I'll talk about that as well. So, but first of all, karma, the word karma itself, in Pali, by the way, it's kama, not karma, means both action, just action, and the results of an action. And it means both those things, sometimes like it seems almost simultaneously. In other words, it's one of those words where there's not a really great, simple, straightforward translation of the word itself. But it means if you act in a wholesome, skillful way, you will create wholesome karma. And if you act in an unwholesome, unskillful way, you will have and create unwholesome karma. So that's there's the action, whatever it is, and then there's the result of that action. And before I go any further, I want to read something from Joseph Goldstein's book, Mindfulness, here. And that's how we, as Westerners, who don't have that innate acceptance of these topics, how we sort of can skillfully work with them. And this is what Joseph Goldstein has to say. For me, there was a very gradual process in opening to these possibilities. I came to Dharma practice from a study of Western philosophy, and I had no belief at all in past and future lives or other realms of existence. Over time, though, several things began to open my mind. First, the more I practiced and studied the Dharma, because so much of what the Buddha taught did resonate with that, what I was experiencing, I began to think that if he was right about so much, maybe I could keep an open mind about what is still beyond my immediate experience. And that's the key. It's like having, if we approach this from, oh yeah, sure, it's that weird stuff, then we're not going to get anywhere. So if we have to have an open mind to start with. And then he says, I began practicing poet Samuel Coleridge's willful suspension of disbelief. Nice phrase, a willful suspension of disbelief. Doesn't mean you have to believe. In fact, the Buddha would say, don't believe. Don't just believe it because it's some sort of rote dogma you have to take in. But to have a willful suspension of disbelief. In other words, consciously choose to go, yeah, that's okay. I'm not buying this, but I'm not rejecting it either. I'm going to stay sort of agnostic to this idea, I suppose you might say. I saw that just as we can become attached to our belief systems, We also become attached to our disbeliefs. That's a good, that's a really good line, I think. Just as we get attached to our belief systems, we also get attached to our disbeliefs. So if you're attached to your disbelief about in this topic, then we have to somehow let that go. And have this suspension of disbelief, a willful. So in other words, it takes energy, it takes effort. Otherwise, we just fall into that old pattern of disbelief. But we have to sort of consciously choose to go there. Okay. And here's one key thing, and this is really an important beginning to understanding, is that for an act of body, speech, or mind to have karmic results, that act must have come intentionally. The intention must be involved. And then that intention results in volition, the actual energy to act, the faculty or power of using one's will. So there's intention, volition occurs, and then we act in some way. And then there's karmic results. So for instance, I'm sort of, at a party. Wouldn't that be nice? And I have my glass of juice in my hand. Of course, it's just a glass of juice. And someone, I'm just standing there talking to someone, blah, 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 blah. And someone comes by and bumps my arm, and I spill my juice on the person I'm talking to. That's not an intentional act. So there's no karmic result, no karmic fruit from that act, because there was no intention. I wasn't saying, well, if I hold my hand just this way with the cup, and then I'll get someone to come along and bump my arm so I can spill juice on this person. There was none of that was there. There was no intention or volition. It was just, it just happened. Very important, because people often think, oh, this, I'm going to have to deal with the karma of this thing that happened, when it was like totally beyond your control. Just sometimes stuff just happens, right? As they say. The other thing is, often, we think, when we think of karma and rebirth, they're sort of tied together. Like, I do something, happens now, and five lifetimes from now or whatever, that's going to pop up, and I'm going to have to deal with it, that karma. But actually, a lot of what happens is we act in some way, and that karma comes to fruit in this lifetime, sometimes quite immediately, sometimes not so immediately, but at some time later on. But it's very much in this lifetime. So it's not like we even have to believe or take into account this idea of past lives and future lives. Because we can see, just then, there's that famous phrase, as you sow, so shall you reap. Like, that's, we sort of understand this in some sort of intuitive level, that, we act in certain ways, and the results of those actions come back, sometimes to bite us and sometimes to make us happy. But they come back. And this is like, it's sort of generally understood, I think, on some level. There's a story one of my teachers tells. This is Guy Armstrong and James Barras, who are two senior teachers in this lineage, who back in the day were asked to go to a prison in the Bay Area where they lived, where they housed young offenders who were serious crime young offenders, murder, robbery, armed assault, really a tough crowd, basically. And they were asked to go there and teach Dhamma. to these guys to see if it would sort of help them deal with the fact that, you know, they were going to be in prison for a long time, basically. And so they went and they, you know, they taught this and they taught, and nothing seemed to be sort of connecting to these guys. That no matter what they would try, it just didn't connect. And then they taught about karma. And one of these prisoners was the leader of the gang, right? And everybody else sort of looked to him. And as they were teaching about karma, he was sort of nodding his head like, oh. And then he said, you mean like, so what goes around comes around. And it's like, yeah, exactly what we, and after that, they had all kinds of questions and they became really interested in the Dhamma. Because it's something that they connected with in their life experience. They knew they had sort of done some things that weren't that great, and here they were in prison. What goes around comes around. You know, it was just the law of the jungle in a way, but that's how it was for them. And so that's one way we can look at it. In another way, and this is an interesting thing I came across, I was looking at all these different sources of information. And this is like, if you can look at in a very sort of step back, long-term view, that all this stuff that happens in this life, in some sense, is simply the fact that you were born. It's a result of your birth. If you didn't take birth, none of this other stuff would have happened. It's an interesting way to look at it. And inevitably, because you took birth, suffering is going to arise, because like everything else that has, you're impermanent and you're going to get sick and you're going to get old and you're going to die. This is like, that's the karma of taking birth, in a sense. The action of taking birth has this result. And it's just, that's the way it is. It's like, then there's also this thing of memory, how memory affects this in some way. You think of some wholesome act that you've done. And maybe it's just some little thing like, you know, helping someone across the street, or helping a neighbor, you know, take care of their cat while they were away, or, you know, who knows, some little thing, but it was a wholesome act. And now, think about it now, remember that act. And it feels good. That's wholesome karma coming to fruit, just like that. It was a wholesome action and wholesome, and it's that happiness that we feel remembering that wholesome act is wholesome karma coming to fruit in our lives right as we have that thought. Another interesting way to look at it. Of course, the flip side of that is when we remember unwholesome acts, we also get to bear the fruit of the unwholesome karma, and we feel miserable sometimes when we think back, oh God, how could I ever have done that? You know, and that's just what goes around comes around, right? This is, that's the way karma works in a sense. Now, here's another thing. I want to actually, there's a long section in the Samyutta Nikaya I want to read. And this is the Buddha talking about karma. And in the sutta, in many places, the Buddha is talking to students, disciples, followers of other sects, other groups who have differing views from the what the Buddha knew or thought he knew was correct. And so there are lots of suttas where the Buddha is explaining to someone who comes to him and says, well, this is what we believe. And he goes, no. And this is, I think, really points to a very important aspect of karma that's totally misunderstood in our culture. So I think this is a really important thing. So on one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling in Rajagata. Then a wanderer approached the Blessed One and exchanged greetings with him. When they had concluded their greetings and cordial talk, he sat down to one side and said to the Blessed One, Master Gotama, there are some ascetics and Brahmins who hold such a doctrine and view as this. Whatever a person experiences, whether it be pleasant or painful, or neither pleasant nor painful, all that is caused by what he has done in the past. So basically, this is stating the doctrine of predestination. Everything that happens to you is because of something you did in the past. Everything that arises in this life is the results of things from maybe earlier in this life or maybe from past lives. You can look at it either way. And the Buddha says, Master Gotama, what does Master Gotama say about this? Some feelings, Shivaka, arise here originating from bile disorders. One can know for oneself, and that is considered to be true in the world. Now, when those ascetics and Brahmins hold such a doctrine and view as this, whatever a person experiences, whether it be pleasant or painful, or neither pleasant nor painful, all that is caused by what he has done in the past, they overshoot what one knows by oneself, and they overshoot what is considered to be true in the world. Therefore, I say that this is wrong on the part of those ascetics and Brahmins. And then he goes on, he says, some feelings, Shivaka, arise here originating from phlegm disorders, originating from wind disorders, originating from an imbalance of the three. This is the medical teachings of the time. Produced by changes of climate, produced by careless behavior, caused by assault, produced as the result of karma. That some feelings arise here produced as a result of karma, one can know for oneself. And that is considered to be true in the world. So he's saying, yeah, karma does play a part. But it could, that thing that just occurred could just as easily have been because you had gas. Or some random thing happened and you got assaulted. You were just walking on the wrong, being in the wrong place at the wrong time, you know, that sort of phrase. Or, you know, it's a natural disaster. You know, you just happen to be here and like those people in Texas right now, you're caught in this world that's just turned upside down by the weather and the lack of political will to do things about it. But I'm not going to get into politics here. So, this idea that somehow our whole life is predestined. Like from the moment we're born, everything that happened is somehow written in some book, you know, some record that says this is the stuff that Barry's going to have to deal with no matter what. He's going to get, this is going to happen and then this is going to, it's like, you know, just one thing after another. And that's what the Buddha's basically saying is, no, that's absolutely not true. Though this is the view that a lot of people hold about karma. Like, I knew this woman, a student of mine way back when I lived in Canada, who always said, when she just was one of these people who was sort of unhappy and was always like, oh, I have such bad karma in this life. Oh, it was like everything was because of karma. and that's how it was, and she was nothing, and but that gave her the excuse to do nothing about it, because it's all predestined, right? Nothing I can do about this. And that's not what the Buddha encourages us to do at all. He said, look at, yes, some things are, but a lot of things are just what you ate for dinner, or what the guy you bump into on the street ate for dinner, who all of a sudden goes into a rage, for that matter. Totally random stuff. Karma plays it. There are things that arise, but it's not like written, it's not all written someplace that this is what's going to happen. Okay. So, and this also doesn't mean that life is somehow controlled from above. You know, God is going to make everything that happens to you is because God willed it to be that way. This is very common in our culture, right? In certain sections of our culture. You know, what's, well, God wanted it to be this way, so that's the way it is, you know. Basically, you know, you can think of your actions, all those actions of with intention, are like planting little seeds. And eventually seeds go through the cycle, they grow and they sprout, and then there you are with this tree you have to deal with. Whoops, you know, that wasn't there. And you don't know where it came from, but it's from past actions. And that also is true. We do have things that occur in our lives that if we, and we can't figure out why is this happening to me now? Oh, it could be something from back in, and sometimes you can look back and figure out, though don't, I strongly advise you not to try and figure out where all these things come from. You'll, in another place I found a section where they, whoever was writing said, this, trying to figure out your karma and why this is happening to you now will just make you crazy. It said, literally, and this is like a quote from some Buddhist scholar. Don't go there. Don't try and figure it all out, because it's not going to, you just can't. And here's the other piece. How these things that arise in our lives, both things that arise from past karma coming to fruit, and just these random things that just happen because of who knows, causes and conditions, how they affect us is largely determined by our mind state at the time when they occur. Are we mindful as they occur? Are we calm and centered as they occur? Or are we not? Do we meet them with a place of mindfulness and loving kindness? Or do we meet them with something that when our mind is distracted and full of ill will? That has an enormous effect on the results of those things arising. Basically, that's the key, I think, to all of the Buddha's teaching, is that, you know, we can't control what's happening, whether, because some of them is random, some of it is someone we're dealing with, the risings of karma in our life, this life. We can't change that. We can't control that. All we can control, I don't even want to use the word control, all we can do is approach things from with a mindful perspective, so that we don't get caught by these things when they arrive and to go fall into habitual patterns of reaction to them. That's what this practice is all about. It's training us to be able to react skillfully, whatever it is that's arising. Without exception, whatever arises, we're okay with that. We can deal with that. I want to read something else from Joseph Goldstein here. Oops. Examining the deeper implications of this step on the path leads to subtler understandings of the Buddha's teachings. For example, Bhikkhu Bodhi points out that acts of killing can be driven by greed, hatred, or delusion, and that killing driven by hatred is the most serious, particularly if it is premeditated, because there have been many intense mind moments that have gone into planning and thinking about it. The more energy, the more unwholesome energy that was there at the moment you act determines the strength of the karmic reaction. Always the unwholesome karma is proportional to the force and strength and duration of the defilements. Later teachings also explain that the consequences or results of an action are conditioned by the moral qualities of both the actor and the recipient of the act. This is true of both negative and positive actions. For example, on the positive side, gifts are purified both by the motivation of the giver and also the purity of the recipient. In this light, it was considered of inestimable merit to make an offering to the Buddha or to other enlightened beings. And at the same time, in the perfection of generosity, we give without discrimination whenever the opportunity is there. It's not that an act of generosity or an act of harm has some absolute karmic consequence. Rather, the karmic fruits of these actions are conditioned by various factors, including the intensity and duration of the defilements or wholesome motivations and the purity both of the actor and the recipient of the action. That's a long sentence, but it's like interesting. It's like, this isn't like cut and dried, you know, oh, that's worth 37 karmic demerits, no matter what, you know. Yeah, there's like, it's all dependent. That's why it's one of the reasons it says don't try and figure this out, because it's like you have to, it's too complicated to figure out what brought on that thing, what the result of that's going to be. You know, how much am I going to have to pay for that one? Oh my God, it could be, that was a 37 demerit one for sure, you know. Well, we don't know. So don't, and getting caught in trying to figure it out is just going to make you crazy. Okay. So that's the thing about karma. I think the most important thing is that we understand that things aren't, karma does not mean predestination. That it isn't, I was born, I came in with this pile of karma, and that pile of karma is totally going to control my life. It doesn't work that way. It's like it's that pile is part of what's going to affect your life, but there's lots of other things that also affect your life, causes and conditions that have nothing to do with karma. Okay, and then we have rebirth. And first of all, I want to say very precisely, I don't know that this is true. But I'm going to say right now, I don't really know if this is true or not. I haven't consciously experienced it directly. But it does make sense to me. When I think about this and look at it and look what the Buddha said, I go, yeah, on an intellectual level, this makes sense. I don't have the direct knowledge. So I guess I'm saying take this all with a grain of salt and understand that really to understand this, we have to have that direct knowledge. And I'm just teaching from what I've been taught and what I find as I study. Having added, put that caveat into the wind, now I'll continue. So here's the biggest fallacy about rebirth. And it's that somehow or other, we think that rebirth means that me, this personality, Barry, is going to come back in a new body. That I, this idea I have of me as this separate being, is going to get a repeat, or many, many repeats. Excuse me. Sorry about that. So, and this is just simply not true. This person, this who I regard as me, isn't what gets reborn. Does not, I don't get another go round as Barry. Basically, when this is subtle, when you were conceived, at the moment of conception, which by the way, in the Buddhist world, that's when life starts, at the moment of conception. Interesting. At the moment of conception, a bundle of karmic tendencies that have in previous times been attached to other beings descend into the womb, it said. And now, throughout this particular life, that bundle of karmic tendencies plays out in this lifetime. And you keep adding to that bundle. So when I first heard this, I went, yeah. What is this bundle of karmic tendencies? But it's one of those things where there's no good words to describe it. That's the best that my teachers can do to attach words to this. It's like, but it does, let me go on and you'll see how actually it makes quite a lot of sense. So this is from Joseph Goldstein's book, Insight Meditation. And this is talking about this idea of how things work. Although a seed will bear a particular fruit, clearly the seed itself is not the fruit, nor is the seed somehow carried into the fruit. Rather, a process of transformation is happening according to certain laws. The seed grows into a sapling, the sapling into a tree. The tree bears fruit, which brings forth new seed. That first seed is not pulled up through the trunk and then deposited in the fruit, miraculously splitting into all those other little seeds. Rather, the seed undergoes a process of transformation due to certain conditions, such as rain, sun, and fertile soil. Makes sense, right? There's no one element that remains static throughout this process. Rather, one thing becomes another, continuously. What actually happens is the great unfolding from seed to fruit to seed again is an unbroken continuum of becoming, of ceaseless change. In fact, these changes are happening so rapidly and so continuously that to isolate any one moment and call it a thing already solidifies too much and renders too static what is so dynamic and transformational. All the elements of our own mind and body are rising and passing away, changing continuously, transforming in exactly the same way. To say there is no self means that there is no permanent entity that carries over from lifetime to lifetime, or even from moment to moment. So, in a sense, we're being born and dying all the time. Over and over and over, literally from moment to moment. That who you are, who this collection of energy that's being expressed as this particular body is different than it was 2 minutes ago or yesterday. And will be different 2 minutes from now or tomorrow. It's not a thing, it's a process. We are a process of transformation ongoing. It's a bit to take in, but that's what the Buddha says very clearly. So then, what happens when you die, when this body ends? When you die, it is this bundle that continues and takes another birth. Gradually, the nature of that bundle changes, and the being becomes enlightened. So at some point, that bundle of energy is so, of karmic tendencies are so pure, so wholesome, that the being that takes on that bundle reaches enlightenment. And here's the interesting thing. That's the end of that bundle. It's gone. At the end of that enlightened being's life, that bundle has served its purpose, which was to progress towards creating an enlightened being. That enlightened being then teaches and leads others, is of great benefit to the world. But that bundle that came with that enlightened being is attached to is impermanent, just like everything else. There's no permanence. It's like, this is different than the idea in the West of a soul, where somehow a soul is permanent. Right? Everything else is impermanent, but my soul, it's going to last forever. And even though, and that's how this idea differs. It's like this bundle of karmic tendencies keeps changing. It's constantly being changed. Every moment is changing, is changing, is changing, is changing. But it's sort of slowly progressing towards more wholesomeness and less unwholesomeness. Until at one point it's so wholesome, so predominantly wholesome, that the being becomes enlightened. Then lives in the world as an enlightened being, which is an enormous benefit to the world. Then it's gone. That's the nature of everything, including bundles of karmic energy. That's the way things are. So then there's this. This is a. I want to read another thing, which maybe approaches this from a somewhat more intellectual, perhaps almost Western angle, but it explains it quite well. This is a marvelous book. If you want a book on Buddhist thought that sort of from a Western mind, I suppose, would be the best way to put this. This is What the Buddha Taught. This is like a summary of all the major teachings of the Buddha. It's by someone named Walpola Rahula, W-A-L-P-O-L-A, Rahula, R-A-H-U-L-A, Walpola Rahula, What the Buddha Taught. And I keep going back to this book all the time. I've had it for years and years and years. One of my very first teachers encouraged me to look at this book, and I stuck with it. And anyhow, enough about the book. Here's what it has to say. Okay, now another question arises. If there is no permanent, unchanging entity or substance like self or soul, what is it that can re-exist or be reborn after death? Which is the classic question that gets asked about Buddhist teachings. Before we go on to life after death, let us consider what this life is and how it continues now. What we call life, as we have so often repeated, is the combination of the five aggregates. Back to my teaching a couple of weeks ago. A combination of physical and mental energies. These are constantly changing. They do not remain the same for two consecutive moments. Every moment they are born and they die. Thus, even now, during this lifetime, every moment we are born and die, but we continue. If we can understand that in this life we can continue without a permanent, unchanging substance like self or soul, why can't we understand that those forces themselves can continue without a self or soul behind them after the non-functioning of this body? If there's no self now, why does there have to be anything that continues? When this physical body is no more capable of functioning, energies do not die with it, but continue to take some other shape or form, which we call another life. In a child, all the physical, mental, and intellectual faculties are tender and weak, but they have within them the potentiality to produce a full-grown man. Physical and mental energies which constitute the so-called being have within themselves the power to take a new form and grow gradually and gather force to the full. It's an interesting way to look at it. It's like that if we accept the idea that we're not a separate self, that we're just this ongoing, continuing process, then it's not much of a leap to think, oh, this energy is attached to this body. This body is gone. Then the energy just attaches to another one and continues and changes and grows, continually changing and growing every moment without fail. It's just that's the nature, in a sense, of life. So now we come to the difficulty. All what I've said has this potential to make you think, well, why do I bother trying to be good or wholesome or any of those things? If it's not going to make any difference to me in the long term, I don't get the benefit of it beyond when this life, this body goes and I did always live this really wholesome life and so pure and all that stuff. So what? Why bother? It's a dangerous place our mind can easily go once we take what I've said in. Why bother? Why is it so important that I try and lead a wholesome life? And there's three things I want to point out here. Well, two in particular. One is that in this very life, we reap the benefits of our wholesome acts. That's also very clear. You know, so even if we don't benefit beyond we, meaning this personality, don't benefit at all from anything that we do beyond this particular physical life of this particular physical form, we still get incredible benefit from acting wholesomely. Just think about the wholesome things you've done in your life and how much they benefited you. It's just true. It's like that, we don't need to sort of think about that. It's not like a straight line. Well, I did this wholesome thing and now I get all the benefits. Doesn't mean I'm not going to have difficulties in my life. But I think it does mean if I didn't have all those wholesome acts that I performed earlier in my life, I'd probably have an even more difficult life than I have now. It's how my mind goes anyway. Like, yeah, I can take that part. I can believe that. Because I can see in my life how this practice, which seems to be quite wholesome in my experience anyway, has changed my life dramatically over the last 15, 20 years. It's a long time, but it's like that's the timeline of this. Isn't like, well, I do some wholesome acts today and well, that's it. Now I'm going to be living in happy land the rest of my life. It's a long-term process. But we can look at it that way. And that's one answer to why bother. If I'm not going to reap the benefits, why bother? And here's the other answer. And I think this is a much more profound answer. If how I act and speak and think in this world, in this life, affects in a wholesome way that bundle of karmic energy that's somehow attached to me, and that, in a sense, that bundle of karmic energy, I hate to use the word improves, but I can't think of a better word, grows, perhaps, more closer to enlightenment. That's going to make the world a better place. Because the next being that gets that bundle is going to start a little further along the line than wherever I started. And so on and so on and so on. And that seems really important. If I live a wholesome life, I'm affecting the world as a whole in a wholesome, positive way. That seems like a pretty big incentive in a broad philosophical sort of way, but that's quite an incentive, I think, that we can, through our actions and speech and thoughts, change the world in a very long-term way, perhaps, but that's okay. Things are moving in a certain direction. This bundle that's attached to me is one day going to become an enlightened being or be connected to a being that becomes enlightened. I got to be careful with the syntax here. And if I can contribute to that in some way, good on me. Because think of what enlightened beings, how they change the world. And how they benefit the world. Good enough for me. So that's the answer to the why bother question that often comes up in this context within these teachings. We do reap the benefits, the fruits of karma in this lifetime, and we also affect the world as a whole and a much longer term perspective. That's also worthwhile as far as I'm concerned. So that's it, karma and rebirth. These are very tightly connected things. One very tightly related. It's pretty hard to believe in one and not the other. It's like you have to sort of, it's like a whole package, like the left hand and the right hand of something. And you need both hands for it to be able to pick something up. So they're separate in some ways, but they're so interrelated and intertwined that it's somehow we have to come to an understanding of them as a whole. And remember what I said at the very beginning, all we have to do now is to suspend our disbelief. Just that. That's a willful act of suspending our disbelief so that we're open to things arising that make us go, oh, yeah, that it makes, it's not just making sense intellectually anymore. I've had in this physical lifetime experiences that were, it seemed very clear to me, were connected to previous times, times before this body was connected to that bundle of energy. It was like, oh, it was like they were very distinct moments where that became clear. Just a few. Nothing recently, but it was like, oh, I can see it. It was like so clear at that time. So, and that's helped me feel comfortable with this. But it's like, it's not, I'm nowhere near like, yeah, I'm sure. It's like, yeah, that, it seems to be what it is. And I'm willfully suspending my disbelief and letting this stuff just sort of evolve in me over time. And as Joseph said, gee, a lot of what else the Buddha said really makes a lot of sense to me. And the Buddha spent a fair amount of time talking about these two topics. This was like, you know, I found just in my study, casually looking several times, I found things where he was referencing these issues and talking about them in various ways. So this isn't like a just some sort of weird Eastern cultural thing. It's integral to the Buddhist teachings. And we have to sort of take them in and at least be able to suspend our disbelief and be open to gradually understanding them on deeper levels. So that's all I have to say. So as usual, I'm now going to open the floor and see if there are any questions or comments or thoughts. Just turn on your mic and speak. It's not a big enough crowd here that it's going to make too much difference that we don't have to use the magic hand method. And, or you can wave to me and I'll tell you to speak, or you can just look, you look kind of stunned. Oh my God, what's he done to me? And that's okay. Even if all you can do is say, yeah, well, at least now I can suspend my disbelief. I can shift from this, I don't believe in this stuff, to like, oh, well, it sort of makes sense. If that's all that's happened tonight, that's an incredible step forward. Just that. Be able to go, yeah, I can at least accept that this is a possibility and I'm willing to explore it. That's where we have to often begin with this, for us Westerners in particular. Okay. Then I will finish with a poem as usual. This is outside my usual poetry readings, I think. It's once again Mary Oliver, but it's from her book Thirst. And this is a book of poems that she wrote right after her longtime partner died. And it has that a flavor of that death running through the poems in some sense. It's also when she became much more devoutly Christian. So there's a flavor of that in some of these poems as well. But it just, this particular one works for me. So it's called Praying. It does not have to be the blue iris. It could be weeds in a vacant lot or a few small stones. Just pay attention. Then patch a few words together and don't try to make them elaborate. This isn't a contest, but the doorway into thanks and a silence in which another voice may speak. Perfect. That's suspending disbelief and opening to something greater. Let's dedicate the merit of the practice. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere.